Podcasting from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area in California, this is Venus Rising, where we discuss all things related to big fertility and encourage you to think beyond the masses. I'm Callie Fell, your host, bringing you the best and most up-to-date conversations on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health. Hello, and welcome back to Venus Rising. I'm your host, Callie Fell, the Executive Director of the Center for Bioethics and Culture Network. Today, I have the privilege of sitting down with Emily. Emily is a mother of three children, a postpartum nurse, lactation consultant, and a writer. Emily's background in women's health and various experiences with birth and mothering informs the questions that she seeks to explore in her writing. She's interested in examining the inherent incongruencies between our physiological realities and needs as mothers versus the expectations of the modern state and market in the setting of an industrial technological society. Through her writing on this vast topic and how it touches women and children, she hopes to spark critical thought and reverence for life, vitality, and all that is good. So she's among friends here in Venus Rising. Emily actually reached out to us at the CBCN after writing about her near-miss experience as an almost egg donor at just 19 years old. Why didn't Emily commit to becoming an egg donor? And what did she find out about the clinic who recruited her? Those are just a couple of the questions that we're going to find out today in our episode of Venus Rising. So first, let me introduce Emily. Thank you so much for taking time out of your week to join us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate being here.
Yes. And if you don't follow Emily's writing, I'm going to give you the information at the end of the episode where to find that. She can be found on Substack and Instagram. But your writing is so compelling, so articulate, and it really does. It gives us an opportunity to kind of critically think about these topics. And so today, since you're on Venus Rising and we talk about women's health, we're going to talk about your particular article that you sent us. That is an amazing article. I encourage everyone to read it. About your story as an almost egg donor. So if you don't mind, let's start there. I'm going to open up the floor. You can kind of talk about your experience. You know, why did you want to be an egg donor at 19? Or did you connect with, we know you connected with a clinic. How did that process go? And then what made you ultimately say, no, you know what, I'm not going to do this. And then we'll touch base with what happened after.
Yeah. So the article is called "That One Time I Almost Donated My Eggs." It's probably not my most articulate title, but sometimes I just put it out there what it's going to be about. And it is a story based on many years ago when I was 19 years old, I did almost donate my eggs. And I start the article out talking about another situation in which when I was in nursing school, I went to Planned Parenthood because I was considering getting an IUD, and I was sitting in the waiting room and looked up at the TV screen and saw my own face looking back at me. I was talking about condoms and why they're a good option for birth control. And this was a video that I had recorded with bedsider.org, which is still up and running today. Very ironically, it's the website that all the residents at my job currently recommend our patients go look at to choose what birth control option they want. And my video is still up there.
Oh, you're still on the website.
Yes. When I wrote this, I went and checked. I was like, oh, there I am. but I recorded that as a result of looking up various ways to make money on Craigslist. I don't think that Craigslist still has the gigs option on that website anymore, but that way back when in the late 2000s, that was a thing where it was just like kind of random jobs, some of them legit, some of them were more like, you know, selling pictures of your feet kind of thing. And I had reached out to them and they gave me like $100 to record this video about condoms, which was extremely embarrassing at the time. But the reason why I was doing these things and looking for these sort of random ways to make money, despite the fact that I actually had three jobs at the time, was because I was on heroin. I was a heroin addict at the time. Myself and my ex-boyfriend at the time both had that habit. So it was, you know, just an act of desperation of ways to come up with money. It was kind of like from sun up to sundown. That's what you kind of do when you're in that place. Mm-hmm. I also was in a relationship with somebody who was very controlling and manipulative and financially abusive, among other things. So I was always trying to find ways to give him what he wanted. So that leads in the article, I kind of started out with that story as it's fairly, you know, humorous, innocent, to lead into the story of the egg donation, because that is the same place, the Craigslist gigs section, where I found all the egg donation ads, of which I replied to several of them. I got several replies pretty quickly. And I remember going through them and doing the applications and everything and feeling like just the sense of something is off here. The questions that were asked felt very invasive. I think I went into it thinking, you know, I was 19 years old. I wasn't really considering what any of this really, like the weight that it held, which is part of why I'm so critical of this whole industry now. Because, you know, when you're 18, 19 years old, you can go and do this and you're still a child, really.
Right.
And that's why I wasn't thinking clearly, among the other reasons, you know, being a drug addict and everything as well. But despite that, I still had that sort of inner knowing, like, why are they asking what my philosophy on life is? Or like, you know, why do they want pictures of my family and my sister? And that's like the kind of things they were asking for. And it just felt very invasive and creepy, I guess is the word I would say. But I did it. I went ahead and filled all the stuff out and gave them all my physical details, my test scores from school and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And what I talk about in the article as it pertains to that part of the story, the applications, is, you know, I told them I have blue eyes. I have long brown hair. I got, you know, an almost 4.0 in school, all this, you know, positive things about myself.
Sure, sure.
But I simultaneously left out all of my addiction problems, all of the like mental health kind of stuff I had going along with that. And on my end, that's just an act of desperation again.
Well, you're trying to sell yourself, right? Like, you want to be hired so that you can get the money that comes with egg donation. So you're selling yourself in the best light. And did you find that it was easy to kind of manipulate the questions? I mean, was there an evaluation or?
No, I did find it easy. And like, I have like shame around that now too, because it's like, you know, while the whole industry is coercive, I too was being coercive. And I think that's why I wanted to write that article and also talk to you, is because I wanted to show the other side of these things. Because, you know, it's so easy to look at the testimonials and all the nice stories you see on the news and People magazine and those sort of things, mm-hmm. of, you know, this generous, gracious person doing this ultimate act of good. Whereas I kind of wanted to shine some light on the perspective of the type of woman who may be getting into this, mm-hmm. out of total desperation. The same reason women go into sex work and that kind of thing. And it's not because I wanted to hurt other people or I didn't want to lie about those things. And that's part of why I didn't do it. I was like, well, I'll just get clean for a little while so that I can pass these drug tests and I'll go ahead and get through it and get it over with. And I kind of told myself as a way of like bypassing the guilt, but just like still having to even consider doing that and telling myself those things shows that the entire situation, it's like a desperate person reaching out to desperate people, I think is what I'm trying to say.
So. Yeah. On one hand, you have someone who's really desperate to have a family or baby, and then you have someone who is willing to meet that desperation out of their own desperation, whatever that might be. I recently read an article, and Diane Tober does a lot of work in the space of egg donation. And I like to use donation in quotes because it's not, like you're saying, it's not a donation. You're not going in, giving this freely. You're being paid. And that is we don't pay for organs. We don't pay, that's illegal. But yet mm-hmm. this is okay. But mm-hmm. she talks about how young women are targeted. One, because they're young and healthy, but also they have this the role of college debt too. Not only other things that are going on. I've talked to Liz Schreier, who is on the board or was on the board at the time of our interview of We Are Egg Donors, an online group for folks who donate eggs. And she just talks about the coercive nature. And she donated her eggs because her mother was facing eviction. So these aren't people who are doing well. Right. Who are yeah. So do you think that the majority are in your shoes? Have you met other potential egg donors or those who went through with it since your time?
I haven't met anybody mm-hmm. Who has, at least anybody who has divulged that information to me.
Sure.
I feel like it's easy. Like, I think it's a fair assumption to assume that a good portion of these women are doing it for some sort of need. Economic desperation wise, whether it be like the story you just said about the mother getting evicted or someone in their family is sick. I have read stories about women whose children had cancer they needed to pay for the treatment for. My own reason wasn't such a, it wasn't a good reason. like
it doesn't matter. The point, yeah, it doesn't matter. And I don't think that there's, that doesn't matter. I don't think.
Yeah. I mean, it's such an ethically messy thing to just add that kind of factor on top of it. I think it just kind of really illuminates how insidious it really is. Mm-hmm. And like you said, if there's no money being exchanged, how many people would actually choose to do this? I don't think many would.
So do you then, obviously don't have experience in this, but knowing your process of egg donation and the battle you were internally having, and now doing work in women's healthcare and writing and thinking critically about these, what do you think then too about maybe sperm donation or surrogacy? We did a study in surrogacy, the Center for Bioethics and Culture Network, where we interviewed 96 women in the United States, and not one of them was in the upper three tiers of the tax brackets. They were all in the lower. Most of them talked about how they were doing it for altruistic reasons. But then when we kind of asked deeper questions, there was clearly also a huge financial component to it.
Yeah. Surrogacy is something I'm very, very critical of. And it's because I've seen it in person. Like, I've taken care of the surrogates mm-hmm. as a postpartum nurse. And I've also heard other nurses tell stories about women they've taken care of at a time when I didn't work there. So, I mean, I would be critical of it whether or not I had those experiences. But mm-hmm. I think especially seeing the way they can be treated afterwards as they're,
Can you give more detail into that without, of course, being very careful to protect with HIPAA and everything? So,
yeah.
Could you give any details as far as the care that you've seen?
I mean, one thing that always kind of stuck out to me was a time when the family who the intended parents, I guess, they had to fly in from out of state at last minute. They missed the birth. And then after the baby was born, they just went because they were, they're like tourists in our town. We're and based in St. Louis, and they're taking their other kids to the zoo and going to the restaurants and all this stuff while the surrogate is there recovering. And, also the baby is there alone. it's so strange to me. This, you have this new baby and you're out at the zoo with your other kids, while the baby's in the hospital alone, the surrogate is laying there by herself alone. I don't know. Just seeing that it's just so strange to me. It's so disconnected from the actual way that birth happens, that bonding happens between infants and mothers. That's honestly probably more in reference to the way it affects the child.
Right.
Not so much the surrogate.
But both, they're interconnected. People keep forgetting. Yeah. I feel like I'm like nailing this point home all the time, but people keep forgetting the fourth trimester, which is the weeks after delivery, and how critical it is for a mother's health and a baby's health. Like, studies have shown like skin to skin is important. And interestingly, in our study, I mean, actually not that interestingly, but the surrogate mothers are more likely to have postpartum depression with their surrogate pregnancies than their own. Why? You know, that's because we're severing that. And there's so much known already. I mean, I'm in California where I think by 2025, every hospital has to be like baby friendly, or at least have that sort of standard, not necessarily maybe that particular organization. And one of the tenets of that is like skin to skin right away and exclusive breastfeeding. And then surrogacy, it's just like, we're like, oh, well, it doesn't matter. Those studies don't matter. Right. Like, it's okay. We'll turn a blind eye. It's completely adult centered. I think your story there kind of just shows like,
yeah,
baby is a product. It was purchased. Once it's ready to be released, then they'll come pick up their product.
Ugh. Right. Which I can't even put into words the feeling it gave me. It's just like, it's strange. It's not, it doesn't make sense to me, like in my body, I guess. Like, I'm just like, what's happening here? As far as like it being, we forget about the child. And I think going back to your question about sperm donation, that's where I was trying to go with that, is I think it's easier to look at sperm donation as not such a problematic thing because there's not the pregnancy and the birth and all that stuff that's attached to it. But when you look at it from the rights of the child to know their parents, it's just as problematic. Which I'm sure you probably know the work of Katie Faust and all of that, child's rights and natural law and all that stuff. I think that's a really important factor to look at. And then in contrast to surrogacy, I think surrogacy is obviously like just a more dramatic thing to think about because it's literally using a woman's body to incubate someone else's child, but both are equally problematic.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have sidestepped a great deal from your story, which is totally fine. I love having another nurse, especially a nurse who does women's health work, on the show. And I apologize to our listeners for sidestepping, but I do think it's an important conversation that we have. But let's get back to your story. So you decide not to do the egg donation, basically on the grounds of you decide that you can't lie about your addiction. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was guilt around that, not knowing the effects that could potentially have on this potential baby. I, you know, despite the fact that I wouldn't be raising it, I held a lot of guilt around that. I was generally healthy, but I didn't know how that could potentially affect things. And that made me feel bad. So that was a big factor. And just, I think the idea of having a child that is mine walking around in the world, like existing without me, really started to bother me. I was like dreaming about it. So a combination of both of those things. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just not show up to my appointment.
Yeah. So how far did you get in the process? You filled out the paperwork. Did you get matched with the family? Talk a little bit about where you got, and then we'll talk about after.
Sure. A lot of this is honestly sort of fuzzy to me at this point because it was so long ago. I'm 33 now and I was 19 at the time. I know I filled out all the applications. I was told that I was chosen and I made an appointment to go get my like initial like blood work and all that kind of stuff done. And I made the appointment and I didn't show up. That's pretty much, I like went through my old emails trying to figure out like what all did I actually do? Because not only was it long ago, but I talk about this a little bit in the article. That time in my life, those like 3-ish years when I was on drugs, I don't have I don't have all of my memories from that time of my life. But yeah, I do know I was matched, someone picked me, and I just ghosted, I guess. Would be
the millennial term. We ghosted them. And then you found out how did you find out? You found out something really critical about, so even though you used Craigslist as like where you found the the gig of donating your eggs. It was a clinic. It was like a real clinic, a certified, you know, a real fertility clinic that existed that was legit, so to speak. Correct? Like it wasn't something that was like shady, weird.
Well, yes and no.
Right. So, but it gets that way. So let's talk about that. Like how, yeah, let's just spill the beans here.
Yeah. So there were multiple people that I talked to, but the person I ended up like actually getting matched through, her name was Janae Helgerson. And when I was going through those emails while I was kind of researching what I was going to write about, I looked up a few of the names that I found, including hers. And I really wasn't expecting to find anything. I was kind of just curious about like, does this person still do this? And I'm forgetting the name of like whatever the clinic she was working through was.
I think it was something Midwest.
It was something Midwest.
Midwest Egg Donation, I think was the clinic or organization.
That sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I looked her name up and like the first thing that came up was an article on the FBI's website because she had been indicted on federal charges of fraud for not paying the women whose eggs she facilitated the harvest of. And it was in that time frame of when I was speaking with her. So I know that if I had gone through that, I likely would not have been compensated for it. I even found like some of the legal documents from the court proceedings. And it's ironic being that the hospital system I currently work for was who she was working with to do the actual harvesting of eggs.
Well, she's not just the broker. You know, she was from what I understand, she owned the clinic. She managed the clinic. Like this is someone who is like pretty high. I'm the highest up you can get, I think, for a clinic.
Yeah.
And then a couple of years later, she was found guilty of fraud and defrauding the egg donors, mm-hmm. wire fraud. Yeah. But yeah, she was arrested and indicted for that. So
yeah,
that is.
Well, and like, sorry.
No, please go.
Finding that out, like in the process of writing this and kind of like revisiting that part of my life where I was at and mentally and everything, I was like shocked, of course, but I was like, what a perfect illustration of my exact point that I'm trying to make. Because kind of like what I was saying earlier, it was like me being desperate. She's clearly desperate on some level. And neither of those sentiments belongs in the realm of reproduction and creating a human life. Like that's really the point I want to kind of drive home is you should not be, you know, approaching the like sacred act of creating a soul, a life from those places, that place of desperation. I keep using that word, but that's really just the only way to describe it.
Children aren't an answer to our desperation or the problem. And that's ultimately what it is. And unfortunately, I don't think that at the time that made a huge splash in the news. But unfortunately, there are a few that do make big splashes as far as like the deception and the wrongdoings of these clinics. Because at the end of the day, the fertility industry isn't mainly operated by physicians. Of course, there are physicians that work for fertility clinics. They do the work, and I'm not. Mm-hmm. There aren't exceptions to that. But most of the time, these are people who are in business because they know that third party reproduction, which includes surrogacy and egg donation, are money making. We're profiting off of women's bodies. Whatever headspace they might be in, wherever they might come from it. And then we're also profiting or commodifying a child, a baby. There's no way in my mind that we get around that at all.
Right.
I think, like you said, if we did, you know, I think it should all be abolished. I don't think that we should even allow altruistic surrogacy or egg donation because you can't mitigate health risks. You can't get rid of all of the risks. And so I just don't think it's a practice we should have. But mm-hmm. even if you did say, okay, we can allow altruistic, I don't really think we'd have, I think there'd be a shortage. I think, and that's why places where altruistic surrogacy, like other countries where that's legal, but not commercial surrogacy, that's still why we see intended parents traveling to the United States or traveling to Mexico or traveling to what you know, India used to be a big hub, or traveling yeah. to all of these places also that are, you know, if you think of the list of places that are exploited for surrogacy, it's Mexico. We've got, you know, Romania, like not, or Ukraine. I'm sorry, I misspoke. Ukraine. These are countries that have really lax laws, or the women are, they're likely impoverished, right? So I think you're just really hitting on with your article such an important topic, and such, we need to be thinking about this so much more critically than we are.
Yeah. And that's kind of, my, like, at the end of it, I kind of get into, even if you are doing it just because you enjoy being pregnant, or you really just have so much empathy for people who want children, you know, the reasons you hear people state all of the time. And I truly believe that choosing to do that is just legitimizing something that also hurts other women. And is it worth directly helping one woman when you're indirectly harming many others? Because when you legitimize this practice by doing it, it makes it okay for others to do it. And not just in their own mind, but in the public's mind, the public opinion of what this is. Because you only see those nice, you know, fluffy stories in the news. And most people aren't looking into it because they don't have a, you know, horse in the race or whatever. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, I recently on Facebook, I'm a part of a group for, you know, women's health nursing and other professionals. And I recently saw someone post about the two babies that were just born from, I think it was 30-year-old eggs or something. And everyone's commenting about how beautiful it is and how wonderful and all this. And I was like, I don't even eat chicken in the freezer that's over a month old. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like, why can't we? And I'm disappointed sometimes in the nursing profession that we're not thinking more critically about these things. It's okay to think critically about these things, and it's okay to disagree, and you can still be kind, and you can still be happy for a family. It's a tough place to be in, but I think we have to stop glossing over the conversation, so I was just kind of shocked and appalled. And I see these kinds of things happen all the time where, like, there's a surrogacy story and everyone's like, oh, this is so great. This is so wonderful. This family. And I'm like, I just want to know the details. Like, and then we've had surrogate mothers die, you know, from complications, and it's just a messy thing. So what would you say, I guess, to anyone who's listening that might be considering donating their eggs? And again, I'm going to put donate quotes.
Sure. Well, I think, you know, in the answering this question, I'm answering it thinking about talking to my own, like, young self, or any younger woman being that they are who is targeted. I would say that it's not worth it, that it's too much to ask of you. I really, really understood the weight of what is being asked of an egg donator.
Donor.
When a few years after this all happened, I got clean and I had my own child. I got clean because I got pregnant with her. I gave birth to her. And I remember thinking after I gave birth that, like, this is what I was giving up. I think if you don't have your own children and you're young and you want to pay for college, you want to pay to travel, you want to do all of that, it's really easy to focus just on these fun things that you can pay for or take care of, you know, take care of things that you need to take care of that are weighing on your shoulders or whatever. It's easy to just focus on those things because your own fertility, your own child rearing experience is so far off in your mind. And also you have that sort of invincibility kind of thing when you're young and you're not thinking about how this could potentially affect your own health, your own fertility. And I think about it in this way that, like, say I did do it and my own fertility was affected. And there's this alternative world where I would have children out there walking around in the world that I would never know existing without me. And I have three children now. I wouldn't have them. And I just would encourage young women to consider those alternative worlds per se.
Yeah.
For them. Yeah.
Yeah. And you kind of hit on a point that we won't go into, but I've had many donor conceived people on the podcast, and they talk about, you know, finding out that they do have a family, a genetic family outside of the family that raised them, and just the implications of that. And I think it's hard as, again, 18, 19, 20, 21 year old to think about, like you said, not only your own health risks, which they do not tell you about, they do not give, because they do not understand them completely, because there's no registry, there's no research on these women, but you're not thinking about your own health, your own risks that you might be taking, but you're certainly, gosh, I was in no way to think about me having one, a genetic child out walking around, and then also what they might feel like as they grow up and they think about their birth story and their genetic link. And now with the state of birth certificates, it's children can go a long time without knowing. Thankfully, we have like 23andMe and Ancestry, and those have all helped kind of reconcile those relationships. But man, it can be really devastating on a person. And studies have shown that. So I think you hit on so much with that advice. Would you say anything to someone who might be considering using an egg donor? What would you say to them?
I would say that they need to consider kind of all of what we've been talking about here, why that woman is doing this. I would say to kind of dig down deeper and look past the altruistic stories that you hear, to really pay attention to both sides of the reasoning as to why someone would want to be doing this. I think when you're that desperate and want a child so desperately, which I truly have a lot of empathy for, I can see how it would be easy to put your blinders on and just not hear that these things.
Absolutely.
You know, but I think you have to find it within yourself to dig down into the truth of the matter and know that a lot of these women who you could potentially be using the genetic material of for your own gain are doing it because they are economically desperate. They have, you know, in my case with my drug addiction and everything, I had a lot of mental stuff going on and everything too. I would just encourage them to think about that. Think about the reality of the situation. Yeah.
Yeah. So you write pretty often on Substack. And I appreciate you going into that article a little bit more, and we'll provide a link for that and just starting that conversation. But I wanted to ask you kind of lastly, what other things do you write on that you find that we need to have a conversation about? Or what is it that you would like people to focus on?
Yeah. Well, when I started my Substack, I called it women's work, and I really wanted to focus more on like the work that women do in the world. And that is still a direction I'm going in, but it's really kind of gotten into a lot of, mainly mothering is the topic I get into, but it's mothering in the modern world where I feel, and I'm sure you understand too, being a mother and a working mother, the push and pull that is required of us and that society places on us in terms of the economic pressure to work, to leave our children, daycare and childcare, and that whole kind of thing is a topic I've been talking about. And how it affects children. Natalism and antinatalism is a thing I'm very interested in. The whole trans conversation is something I talk about. And really just femininity in general. But not, you know, you hear all like the trad wife kind of stuff. I really approach everything from a physiological standpoint and just the female experience, I guess, would be a good to sum it all up, but especially with mothering related topics, breastfeeding, things like that.
Yeah. Well, you come at it with expertise in that. And I think It is hard. I saw a meme the other day and it was like the perfect. It was like, I'm going to be a mom like I have no job, but I'm going to work like I have no children. And then I was like, yep, that's it. How do I get there? It's impossible. But so it's nice. Yeah. I'm glad you're writing on that and I appreciate that. And, you know, you brought up the transgender debate and we have entered that field as well, or that conversation, because again, how it affects reproduction. Kids who are put on blockers and then cross-sex hormones are making decisions very young about their fertility, which again, can they consent to that? Can they say, I don't want children, so I don't want fertility preservation? And then fertility preservation that's offered is, lacking to say the least. Science experiment, really. I feel like we could have a whole nother conversation on that, but I'll open the floor if there's anything you'd like to add really quickly on that.
On the transgender?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. it's such a big topic.
Mm-hmm. Well, as it relates to maybe reproduction or our health.
Yeah. The thing that I mainly have written about thus mm-hmm. far was, I don't know if you've seen in the news all the stories about the transgender women or trans-identified males taking pharmaceuticals, domperidone, to induce lactation. So I really got into that topic, and also, but not just the fact that they're doing this, but the fact that medical professionals are supporting them in this, specifically La Leche League, which really kind of grinds my gears, just because La Leche League to me has always been kind of the pinnacle of what breastfeeding support should be. You know, IBCLCs and all that stuff, that's wonderful, but I am very much like woman to woman, mother to mother support is where it's at in terms of breastfeeding support, especially for more basic concerns and things like that. I also think about like the founders of La Leche League. You know, it's like five Catholic ladies in Chicago, I think in the 60s, and what they would think of what the organization has become, whereas today they're kind of texts that they've used, The Womanly Art of Breastfeeding is, you know, it's like a classic text on this that many, many women have read, including myself when I had my first child and was really struggling with breastfeeding. They decided to take the word womanly out of the title. So that's what I wrote about. And I also kind of got into how they have a lot of guidance on their website for helping both women who have transitioned breastfeed, but also actually supporting males in lactation including to welcoming them into support groups with women who, to me, I'm just like, I cannot imagine going to an in-person support group when, you know, in those first few weeks of being super vulnerable, struggling with breastfeeding, trying to get my baby to latch, you know, going to these women, trying to find that support and assistance, and there's a man there. Which, I mean, how often does that happen? Probably not often, but the fact that there's any effort and time and resources being spent on that, to me, is just insane.
Women can barely get the support and help we need, and now we're allowing a minority of males come into that space and take that and take the energy and the focus. I agree. And the fact that we're erasing women for what could be a very small amount of men to make them feel comfortable, included, when we're trying to be the best we can be. So what's your take? I did write an article about products that can be taken and given to enhance and to help males breastfeed. And then I've also written an article most recently with our founder, Jennifer Law, that received quite a bit of attention on Daily Mail and others, criticizing testosterone, women, the opposite. So women taking testosterone while they're pregnant. The fact that that's like a category X, and we're just turning a blind eye to that too. But we'll table that. I want to know since you are a lactation consultant, I'd like to dig in just a little bit deeper before we end. We have a few more minutes. What you think about males breastfeeding.
Oh my gosh. Well,
can it be done right now? Is that nutritious? Let's forget about the fact that we're erasing women by our language and our spaces, and we're giving attention where it doesn't need to be given. What do you think on like a physiological?
I think there's a lot of conflicting information on this. It's not super well studied. They always bring up the point that like women take that same drug when they're struggling with breastfeeding. It is being used off label, whether it's for a male or a woman. That is not what it's prescribed for and approved by the FDA for in the United States. So that's a factor. The amounts of milk, I guess we'll put that in quotations, that these people are able to produce is not enough to nourish a child and actually provide them with the amount of calories that they need, which, you know, that situation comes up with women all the time as well for various medical reasons.
Sure.
But another factor to pay attention to. Mm-hmm. Me, I'm just like, we're clearly trying to cheat nature. We're trying to appease the male's delusions, essentially, and using, again, we're using the baby as a pawn, essentially, to provide an adult with whatever sort of satisfaction or affirmation or whatever that they are seeking. And that, I mean, I guess that's not the answering your question, really.
No, it totally is. It totally is. I appreciate you just gave me the heebie-jeebies while you were talking about it, because you're right. It's all about an adult getting some sort of satisfaction, whether that's through the feeling like they've accomplished something that they shouldn't accomplish, or
yeah
it's all about that. And we're using a baby to do that.
Yeah. And I think people don't realize that it takes a lot of effort for an infant to nurse, especially when they're learning how to in those first few weeks where you are establishing breastfeeding. So anytime they're on there struggling, trying to get whatever liquid is there out, they are burning calories.
Right.
And
right.
That is necessarily fair to them. And at the same time, it's like, well, someone gave birth to this child, clearly not him. That is who that baby needs to be establishing that breastfeeding relationship with. Anytime that baby is hungry and not nursing on the mother, they are losing out on establishing a good milk supply, bonding the way they need to be bonding with the mother. Mm-hmm. So again, it's just that would be more of a physiological factor that I would think about too. So,
well, and the mother that birthed that baby, if not breastfeeding, she's also missing out on the benefits of breastfeeding that we've shown, like decreased risk of cancer later in life. There's all kinds of benefits to women to breastfeed. And of course, there are situations where women can't breastfeed or it's too difficult or something else. And that's okay. But with men, we're creating a problem that doesn't need to be created. That's kind of like how I feel about egg donation or embryos that are on ice. We're creating children that need to be adopted for no reason. We're creating surplus. Like this, we're creating an issue. It's completely different when it's a woman and we're struggling. And that's, again, where the resources need to be put. And from what I understand, that drug is actually really hard for women to get who really need it. But yeah, we're handing it out kind of a little bit like candy when it comes to men. Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing is that I think about is there's a lot of breast changes that happen during pregnancy. Like your areolas get darker. There's a reason for that. That's so that the baby, because babies can't see very well, can distinguish. It's like a bullseye target. Like, oh, there's the nipple. I can see that. Your nipple gets bigger. So the baby can be able to really grasp on that. And I think of like male nipples, you know, they are not as robust. Like they just don't have the material, the tissue there to do it. So yeah, it's really frustrating. I'm really glad we touched on that. Is there anything else you'd like to add or?
No,
I want to give you plenty of time.
To add to what you just said, I would definitely say it is just like the manufacturing of some level of suffering for an innocent child. But yeah, so yeah, that's all I would add.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I'm so glad we kind of touched on that. I'm going to have you back and we'll just like dive more into the science behind this. Because yeah, some medicine has really jumped on this and I'm like, what is happening to the medical establishment? What is happening? Why are we not using the schooling, the education, the all of this information that we know, and we're just sidestepping it so that people, in the name of inclusivity.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. That's well,
talk about like womanhood, breastfeeding, birth, all these things are inherently exclusive.
Yep.
Whether we want to admit it or not. So yeah, I agree with the same feelings you have about medicine and our profession and everything. There's a lot there that we could get into about what's problematic and the sort of pandering to ideology that I think we probably both see.
Yeah.
Healthcare industry. Yeah.
Exactly. For me too, the biggest thing is just like the erasing of women. It really irritates me. We don't give out like an educational handout now because it's not inclusive. It uses the word women. I'm like, oh, so we're just not going to give the education now. We're just not going to give the hotline that they can call, you know, when they're struggling in the middle of the night because we don't want to offend someone.
Oh my gosh.
You know, so, right. And that's not all the time, but someone had said that recently to me. Oh, don't give that out because it's not inclusive. And I was like, what? So
that is not a good reason.
Right. Yeah. Well, our time is coming to an end. I want to be respectful. I've had a really nice chat with you. I want to say thanks so much for taking the time to meet with me and share your very personal story and about your writing. It's been a privilege to have you talk on this show. And if listeners aren't already reading Emily's work, I really want to encourage you to go to her Substack under the newsletter name Women's Work. I'll include the link to that in the show notes, but just for those listening, it's theworkofwomen.substack.com, theworkofwomen.substack.com. And you can also find her on Instagram with the handle tend.her.heart. I'd like to thank each and every listener and subscriber for tuning in. Our goal, as it seems is Emily's, is as ever to create conversation, facilitate discussion, and encourage everyone to think beyond the masses. So, Emily, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Venus Rising. If you like our show and want to know more, check us out at cbc-network.org. Leave us a review on iTunes, too, and join us next week for another conversation on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.